From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made during a campaign stop last month in Ottumwa, Iowa, when former Vice President Joe Biden made a promise. While addressing the crowd, Biden discussed losing loved ones. He talked about how he understood what loss is and when it occurs, and he said, quote, "I promise you, if I'm elected president, you're going to see the single most important thing that changes America. We're going to cure cancer." And the promise drew applause from the crowd. In 2015, Biden lost his eldest son, Beau, to brain cancer. His personal connection to the disease has led to his taking the lead on a number of cancer issues, but Biden isn't the first politician to promise that his administration would cure cancer. At a rally in Orlando last month, President Trump promised to cure cancer if reelected. In 1971, President Richard Nixon signed the National Cancer Act, which launched a campaign to find cures. That was nearly 50 years ago, and today cancer remains the second leading cause of death in the United States and globally. According to the National Cancer Institute, about 39% of American men and women will be diagnosed with cancer at some point in their lifetimes. The numbers beg the question, when will a cure be found? Oncologists and researchers say the question is nuanced and complex, and they worry that promises like Biden's and Trump's will give the public false hope. They say research is complicated, nonlinear, sometimes halted by roadblocks. New technologies and discoveries can't be predicted, and overall, cancer is a complicated disease. Or really, it is a collection of diseases. And some cancers, they say, are more likely than others to be treatable. There is no one-cure-fits-all solution for more than 200 different cancers. This hour, we discuss the latest in cancer research and treatment with our guests, and they're also going to help us understand what finding a cure truly means. Listeners, we understand this is an issue that is often emotional, and you may have questions. This is an outstanding opportunity to get questions and information from two people who are among the most qualified here in Western New York. Dr. Jonathan Friedberg is the director of UR Medicine's Wilmot Cancer Institute. Nice to have you here. Thanks for being here, Doctor.
Thank you so much, Evan.
And also with us is Dr. Farhan Imran, who's a hematologist and an oncologist at the Lipson Cancer Institute at Rochester Regional Health. Dr. Imran, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I want to ask both of you, if we could, just to respond right away here to what we're hearing from presidential contenders. And let's listen, if we could, to what Vice President Biden has said. This is not the first time he has talked about this. As we mentioned in the introduction, he lost his son, Beau, and certainly other people in his life have been touched by it. Here's some of what he said recently.
You know, a lot of you understand that what loss is, and when loss occurs, you know that, you know, people come up to you and tell you, I understand if you lose a husband, a wife, a son, a daughter, a family member, and lots of times you feel like saying, you know, they say, I know how you feel. And if they hadn't, you look at them, you know they mean well, but you say, you have no idea how I feel. But when it happens to you, you know. That's why I've worked so hard in my career to make sure that I promise you, if I'm elected president, you're going to see the single most important thing that changes America is we're going to cure cancer.
I want to ask both of our guests to respond to that. I mean, there's no question the emotional weight and the sincerity of it. But Dr. Friedberg, is are you comfortable with that kind of a promise?
I'll give you the nuanced explanation here. First of all, I think you can hear in his voice the impact that cancer has. And I see this every week when I'm in clinic, what this disease does to people. And I always say that cancer is not a disease of an individual. It affects the entire family and care system. You know, colleagues at work get cancer. There's an impact there. And certainly caregivers suffer often more than the patient, as you heard from what the vice president had to say. Where I think it's a challenge is to imply that there's this word cure and that the winning of the war on cancer means that there's some magic bullet that is going to just take this group of diseases and have it disappear. What we've learned in the 50 years of research and in the 40 plus years of the war on cancer is that this is a very complex group of diseases. Some grow quickly, some grow slowly, some respond to different treatments. And that therefore, I think defining victory in this setting is different from what we conventionally think of as cure. And in my mind, a victory could be if a patient is able to live a normal life and contribute to society and do what they want to do and feel well doing it. Even if not every cancer cell is gone from the body, that's a substantial victory. And we have made such progress, particularly in the last decade in cancer, that I think we're well on our way there to those victories for many patients, even if curing cancer as a group of diseases is going to be a challenge in the next 4 years.
Is it important, Dr. Friedberg, to make that distinction, as well-meaning as whether it's Vice President Biden, President Trump, anyone else talking about curing cancer, making that distinction that there are, what, more than 200 forms of cancer, and that discussing a singular cure is probably, I don't know if misguided is the right word, but we're not talking about one thing here, right?
That's right. I mean, I think when patients or people think of the word cure, what they often think of is you get a strep throat, you take penicillin, and the strep throat is gone and you're cured. Cancer isn't like that. Cancer is our own cells that develop mistakes in them. And it's very difficult to eradicate cells that are normally your own cells from your body without causing a great deal of collateral damage. And that balance has always been a struggle as we've tried to treat cancer over the last decades. So I think it is simplistic. And the problem is we don't want to set this up for failure, where we say 4 years from now, we haven't cured all cancer, so therefore we failed. Because the message, if there's one message I want to give today, is the opposite. We have made tremendous progress in cancer. What we've learned has enabled many, many patients to feel well and live largely normal lives with cancer. And even if they're not cured, if we convert this to a chronic disease like diabetes or high blood pressure that can be easily managed, that's really, in my mind, a major victory.
Dr. Imran, how do you feel about what you heard from the vice president there?
So thanks, Evan, for doing this. Of course, this topic is very dear to many people's hearts. My take on it is that a political statement is different than a scientific statement. And even a statement like that coming from Vice President Biden and President Trump is very welcome to me as a physician, as a family member, as a scientist. For the fact that a statement like that brings renewed focus to a certain topic, it brings funding, and it brings motivation. And if those things are brought in, that in itself is a starting point to do all the research. Now, as scientists and doctors, of course, when we hear something like that, we've been working on trying to, so to say, cure cancer for decades. It's the research has been ongoing. And as Dr. Friedberg is saying, there has been a lot of progress. But the problem with this statement is that it has been made into a very simplistic statement. And sometimes when you're addressing the masses, you have to use statements like that. But within it, the complexity that cancer and all its therapies contains, what we worry about is false hope, but we also don't want to take the hope away from the patients. The treatments have improved so much over the last 50 years that when patients hear cure, they think that, poof, the cancer will be vanished from their body. That's not true. But on the other hand, if 20 years ago, a patient would live maybe 3 months to 6 months, very sick, in bed, and suffering miserably. But in today's day and age, the same patient can live a very decent quality of life, going to the gym, attending school events, family events, and lives like that for a number of years. that in itself is a giant leap. And if you zoom out, the research is ongoing. Who knows in 10 years from now what the landscape would be?
Amen. There's some remarkable forms of progress. And I think as I get ready to, we'll start with phone calls now. So Rick and Aranaquit, I'm going to come to you in just a moment. We'll take your emails at connections@wxxi.org. Because listeners, you can guide the conversation, sharing your thoughts and experience as we talk cancer. But I think our guests are really drawing some important points right out of the gate here. First of all, I have to admit, I mean, listening to Dr. Imran, I hadn't thought about it that way, the benefit of a statement like this. Yes, it's simplistic, but the possible benefit is you can't make that promise without really going after funding, research, prioritization, listening to the scientific and medical community about their needs. So, you know, it's a pretty big promise to make, but you couldn't make it without some kind of a follow-through. So there's a possible benefit. The risk being the oversimplification and the mistaking the idea of, you know, curing a cold means you don't have a cold anymore. Curing cancer means different things to different people. Maybe you die with cancer and not from it, you know, as I often hear about prostate cancer. Of course, not always, but things like that. So just really some important sort of opening thoughts from our guests here. Let's get Rick and Aranaquit, and we'll start with our listener feedback. Go ahead, Rick.
Hi, good afternoon. In the past 20 months, I have been a part of my 36-year-old daughter's journey, which has involved east-west medicine combination. And presently, she was scanned about a week and a half ago, and all her tumors are necrotic and dying. This was brought on by diet change, psych, constant upping of her psyche. These are things that are not presently in our system, especially the diet. There was another family member that was diagnosed about 6 months ago, and it was a GI issue. And he said, well, what about diet? They said, eat what you want. Well, if your body is not alkaline, it is perfect host for cancer. It loves acid. It loves glucose. Eastern medicine recognizes this. And by changing your diet, you are making a hostile environment for that cancer to grow. In regards to treatment, with the evolution of CRISPR and the genes, treatments are becoming extremely customized for each client. My daughter is breaking barriers across the board in that her docs in New York City are talking to her interventionist in Chicago, which has never happened before. And they know, each knows what each is want. Target is, and the result is dying tumors. I really think that A, insurance companies, and B, especially pharmaceuticals, their grip needs to be, shall we say, lightened on the control of the situation. Why must every discovery cost hundreds of thousands of dollars when it could be simple as something such as metformin? Drugs that attack stem cells of the cancer. I mean, I don't want to beat the drum here, but my daughter has people shaking their heads. And just for the docs to understand, her form of cancer is GIST, and she has two mutations, which they've never seen before. And at this point, it really doesn't matter because she's got it by the throat.
Rick, let me let our guests weigh in on what they've heard. Dr. Friedberg, I'll let you start. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, you know, your daughter clearly is demonstrating courage, and, you know, my sympathies for you with having to deal with that for her at such a young age. You do bring up a couple of points that I'll briefly comment on, obviously, given our time constraints. The first is the concept of what I call integrative medicine or integrative oncology. And I think that a holistic approach where you're looking at all aspects of what the patient needs, including borrowing insights from other cultures, is an important direction forward. In fact, here in Rochester, we're considered national leaders in research on symptom management. Back in the 80s, many of the initial studies in using drugs to treat nausea and vomiting associated with cancer treatment started here in Rochester. And today we continue to get significant support from the National Cancer Institute for these types of research projects. And as part of that legacy, we recently opened what we call the Integrative Oncology Center at our Pluta location, which attempts to integrate techniques like acupuncture, nutrition, and other Tai Chi and other types of activities like that into standard care of cancer. Western medicine, as you're labeling it, is a research-oriented way to look at cancer treatment, and we know based on clinical trials what to expect there. Many of these other techniques have not been researched as intensively, but we're seeking to change that. So I think that's an important point. I'm going to reserve discussion that you brought up at the very end regarding costs of treatment. But I will say that your idea and point about precision medicine, where treatments are being chosen based on specific mutations within tumors, is an important trend in oncology, and I think is leading to very favorable outcomes.
Okay. Dr. Imran, would you want to add to that?
Yeah. So I just wanted to say to Rick that it sounds like the whole family, not just the daughter, but Rick himself, is going through a tough time. But you're beating cancer excellent, and we wish the same outcome to all our patients. I think you are pointing out exactly how oncology care should be globally. Remember that all the news flashes that you hear about immune therapy and targeted therapy, those are excellent advances, but those are treating the cancer. Whereas a doctor's main objective is to treat the patient. Now, other than killing the tumor cells, we also have to make sure that the mental and physical well-being is really taken care of. So it can never happen that you just give one drug or one treatment or one surgery, and that will take care of the whole patient. And that brings you to what you're calling the Eastern approach, but I would say this should be the global approach. And just like Dr. Friedberg was saying, that we now have avenues where, other than going through the exact treatment, be it chemotherapy or targeted therapy, focusing on the diet and a nice, healthy, balanced diet and exercise and mental well-being and psychological well-being, these all are as much part of cancer treatment as these other therapies. So I think that you have done that, your daughter has done that, and our focus is to have that kind of approach for all of our patients and their families.
Let me read some feedback via email. Michael says, one of the doctors mentioned that cancer is when the cells of the body malfunction. What causes the malfunction, and is it true that sugar feeds cancer? Doctors.
So in most situations, we don't know what causes the malfunction, although what's remarkable in a sense is that we don't see cancer even more often. The amount of turnover of cells in our body is massive. You're making millions and millions of blood cells every day, for example. And if one of those blood cells has a mistake in it, that in theory can lead to cancer. What we've learned is that it takes several mistakes in a certain order to eventually lead to cancer. And the body has important surveillance mechanisms to try to take care of these mistakes before they develop cancer. But certainly in many situations, environmental exposures, and in some situations, inherited susceptibility can contribute to accelerating these mistakes and increasing the risk of cancer. So that's, in a summary, as far as what we know about what causes cancer, I do think that is an important point to bring up, therefore, about prevention of cancer. And certainly decreasing exposures to things like cigarette smoke has dramatically affected cancer incidence. And we're learning more and more about lifestyle things that we can do to try to minimize cancer from developing.
What about sugar?
So that's a laboratory observation that cancer cells are dependent upon pathways where sugar is differentially utilized in the metabolism of cancer cells. However, it's overly simplistic to then say you shouldn't eat sugar, because you have to realize when you eat sugar, your body regulates how much sugar actually goes into the blood. So if I drink a Coca-Cola and have a big sugar load, insulin in my body takes care of that, and my glucose or sugar level remains stable. If I go on a fast and don't eat sugar, my body breaks down cells to also keep my glucose level stable. So this concept that just because in a laboratory there's an observation metabolically that cancer cells preferentially prefer glucose, that does not mean that changing a diet impacts cancer in a person, because even though you change your diet, your sugar level in your blood doesn't really change.
Okay. You want to add to that, doctor?
Yeah. So I would, on the glucose or the sugar point, we actually get that a lot from patients. So thanks for that question. What happens outside of the body in the lab or in a petri dish is different than what happens inside the body, because the human body is incredibly complex. It's true, a kind of a scan that we do quite often for patients nowadays is called a PET scan, and the material that is used to highlight the tumor tissue also utilizes glucose, because the cancer cells take up the glucose. But what has been proven in the lab has not yet been proven in the human body, and I don't think that there are many concerns. A point that I usually tell patients is that many diabetics who may be walking around with elevated sugar levels all the time, if this theory was totally true, then we would be seeing all these patients to have cancers as well. But that's not true. It's true that they do have cancers as well, but it's not as simple as A or B, that if your sugar is high, then you are going to get cancer. So the next question typically comes is that, should I eliminate sugar from my diet? So no single diet or no single eating plan has shown that this will prevent cancer or treat cancer. But if you just remember one word, which is common sense, that is a healthy, balanced diet, and which has all the components, carbohydrates and fat and protein and green leafy vegetables. So this is typically a good balanced diet, not a lot of processed foods. That's practically the recommendation that we give, and we typically don't ask patients to go on a totally, completely glucose-free diet.
All right, listeners, questions, comments as we talk about cancer, cures, what that looks like, and the future of cancer research and medicine, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections at WXXI.org. Dave in the city of Rochester says, I don't think that enough people realize that cancer is the baggage that accompanied evolution. The occurrence of genetic mutations that provided for evolutionary progress is what at times leads to cancer. Random and environmentally caused mutations are inherent to life and genetics. Thus, a true cure will be very difficult to find, but treatments will continue to improve. This paradigm has helped me approach the diagnosis of patients, as well as my wife, who is an 8-year breast cancer survivor. That's from Dave. You agree with that kind of viewpoint?
Completely. I think that's said in a very nice format. That, and in fact, there are cells in the body by design that are supposed to become mutated in order to do what they need to do. Mutated meaning changes within the cell. And, you know, for example, the lymphomas that I take care of, that's often how they arise, is because those cells at baseline are designed to be vulnerable to these sorts of changes in order to respond to infections. So that is part of the challenge. And that's why this is much harder to treat than an infection, which is clearly something that's foreign. When we try to kill lymphomas or colon cancer cells or brain cancer cells, those cells are essentially your own body, your own cells with just some mistakes in them. So it's very, very difficult to separate those cells from the normal cells. And the legacy of that has been the side effects of treatment, where when we give treatments like chemotherapy or radiation, we haven't been as successful at discriminating between killing the normal cells and killing the tumor cells. The good news is that with many of the more modern advances, including some of them that we've alluded to today, like immunotherapy or these targeted agents, precision medicine agents, we are targeting specifically the mutated cells, and that not only improves outcomes as far as the ability to shrink tumors, but perhaps as importantly, decreases side effects.
Can I ask you briefly about lymphoma? Because that is your specialty.
Yes.
And I'm asking this because I have a family member who, I don't know, Mom and Don, if you're listening back in Cleveland, sometimes they do, especially in the summer. My stepfather has Merkel cell carcinoma. And so I've had to learn a lot about how cancer travels. And what I don't know, even know if I got my head around right now, is how many places in the body we have lymph nodes and how many lymph nodes we have. So can we start there?
Sure. I mean, the analogy that I try to give when I meet a patient is that lymphoma cells are blood cells. So at the very basis, blood is everywhere in the body, you know, absolutely everywhere in the body. So in theory, these blood cells can travel any place in the body and set up shop. Lymph nodes are structures that are really collections of blood cells that are designed to help fight infection and filter the blood, so to speak. There are numerous areas where normal lymph nodes can appear, but lymphomas don't have to respect those areas. And I've seen lymphoma in virtually every organ in the body, in addition to lymph nodes in the bones, in organs like the liver, the kidney, certainly the spleen, the lungs, all of those places. So that doesn't necessarily mean, though, if the lymphoma is widespread like that it's not treatable. And in fact, lymphoma has been one of the best success stories in cancer treatment. I'll choose Hodgkin lymphoma, where in the 1960s, that was a uniformly fatal disease. And now walking in the door with a new diagnosis of Hodgkin lymphoma, even at advanced stages, we cure about 85%. And in that case, I really mean cure, meaning the disease goes away and never comes back. Other lymphomas grow so slowly, we don't even need to be very aggressive about treating them. And then large cell lymphoma has been another success story where the majority of people are cured. However, subsets of patients can now be identified that have more trouble.
So this is where I identify my profound ignorance here. So in my stepfather's case, he had Merkel cell carcinoma, a spot of cancerous cells on his left hand. And after removal of the spot or whatever the technical, what's the cancerous term for whatever that spot would be?
The lesion.
The lesion. There was PET and MRI scans. And of course, great concern among family. This is a cancer that moves pretty quickly. That is, I think a lot of people hear carcinoma and they think, well, that's not melanoma. Melanoma is the bad kind. But Merkel cell, as I have learned, is even worse or can be. So a lot of great consternation, and found that the cancer had spread to the lymph nodes in his armpit, but not beyond, and was given an option to either remove those lymph nodes entirely or undergo radiation. I assume those are common approaches, but what I thought was then, well, the cancer is no longer in his hand. They've removed the lesion. It's spread to the lymph nodes in his armpit. Now he has lymphoma. And they said, no. He still has Merkel cell carcinoma. The name of the cancer that someone has is where it originates, even if it travels. Is that correct? Yeah, is that correct?
So that's an interesting point, because if somebody has breast cancer, it can go to liver, it can go to the bones, it can go to the brain. But when it goes to the other part of the body, it's not called brain cancer. It's still breast cancer that has gone to the brain, something that is stage 4 disease. The way it goes there is twofold. One is the lymphatic system, which runs parallel to the bloodstream, and that has a very predictable path. So, for example, if somebody gets cancer in the left breast, it will very predictably go to the lymph nodes in the armpit first. But the same cancer cells, it's an invasive cancer, meaning it can break into the normal body tissue and it can get into the bloodstream. And just like if you put, if you take watercolor and if you put it, you run tap water, and if you put just one drop into it, a red color or a blue color, you'll see that that color will travel wherever the water goes. So the same thing, this is called the hematogenous spread of cancer. So if one or two or a few cancer cells get into the bloodstream, they will go anywhere in the body. And the immune system will try to fight it off, but if the cancer has become smarter than the immune system, then they will just cause the same kind of cancer spread to that part of the body. So these are the two different ways how cancer will spread.
Evan, I might just add one thing, not to confuse you more, but...
No, this is actually quite clarifying.
Just to show you how things are evolving. So the reason we think about the analogy that he gave of breast cancer going to the liver or the bone, and we're still calling it breast cancer, is because the treatments, generally speaking, have been treatments that are aimed at killing breast cancer cells, because those are breast cancer cells that have moved. What we are starting to do now is, rather than call something breast cancer or lung cancer, we're identifying the disease by the mutation pattern. Since we have the technology to really look at exactly what those mistakes are. And when you do that through sequencing or other fancy techniques, what you can identify is that maybe a subset of breast cancer is better treated like a lung cancer, or specifically some melanomas have the same mutation patterns as some GI cancers. So over time, there's a feeling that we may be renaming some of these cancers, particularly when they spread, more along the lines of what the mutation patterns are than where they originated from. But the reason to do either one of those is the same. It's really to inform the right treatment for the disease.
Learning so much from our guest this hour. Rich in Rochester will take your phone call after the break. Herman in Brighton, I've got an email to read. I've got a lot more feedback from listeners, and still time for listeners if you want to fit in an email or a phone call as we talk to our guests about cancer. If you're just joining us, you've probably heard, whether it's former Vice President Joe Biden, President Trump, or others, talk about curing cancer. And both President Trump and Vice President Biden have mentioned that if they win the 2020 election, their pledge is that cancer will be cured over the next 4 years. We're talking about how likely that is, and frankly, the simplistic nature of that statement, without, you know, sort of casting stones, it's more just a conversation about the complicated nature of cancer itself and the different mutations, the different forms of cancer, what cure actually means, and sometimes what progress actually means with research. You just heard Dr. Jonathan Friedberg, who's director of UR Medicine's Wilmot Cancer Institute, and Dr. Farhan Imran, who is a hematologist and an oncologist at the Lipson Cancer Institute at Rochester Regional Health. We're right back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, a question. What do pickles and kimchi and cheese and beer have in common? They're all fermented. The Cumming Nature Center is hosting the first ever FLX Fermentation Festival. And for the Summer of Food, we dive into all things fermentation. Talk with you Thursday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Rich in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Rich. Hi, Rich. We're going to find you, Rich. We've lost you somewhere. Are you there, Rich? Can you hear us? I'm going to put you back on hold, Rich, if we could, and we're going to get him back. Let me read an email from Herman in Brighton. Herman says, Evan, I attended a talk by Dr. Campbell, who spoke of research showing that consuming dairy products increases the risk of cancer. The noxious component is casein. Do the guests know of this research? Do they have a view on that? Concern about casein and dairy.
So first of all, I would say that I have not heard of that research, But what I would tell you is that we hear about researches similar to that all the time from our patients. When we, as trained professionals or oncologists, when we give recommendations, those are based on large studies, which include hundreds, if not thousands, of patients. And we can only give absolute recommendations if it has been proven and if it has been endorsed by organizations such as FDA and all. I typically joke with my patients that if I was a writer for a medical journal such as WebMD or a lot of other great journals out there, so I would be writing articles like this, and I'm not disregarding any of these, but these bring excellent points, and these are focuses of more research. But until more research is done and it has been proven that a certain substance causes cancer or is not good for you, I don't think that any of us can give a solid recommendation to avoid a certain substance from your diet.
I just say to Herman that it took about 30 years to definitively establish the link between smoking and lung cancer. Smoking was a common exposure, and lung cancer is a very common cancer. And the intensity of the link is that you're many-fold times increased risk of developing lung cancer if you smoke. All these other exposures are less common exposures, and the cancers that they are purported to cause are also less common. It's extremely difficult to make a tight link. We all know people who smoke and don't get lung cancer. So this field of epidemiology is quite complicated, and I think you have to be very careful about associations, which may be observations, don't necessarily mean that one thing causes another.
All right. Rich in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Very good, sir.
There's two things I want to make a point of. I'm having a problem with what Biden and Trump are saying, because there seems to be, for me, there seems to be a level of disingenuousness in the sense that they think they are going to do a Kennedy-esque moonshot analogy. And that bothers me, because I don't think cancer should be looked at it. As your doctors are saying, this is one of the most intricate, trickiest diseases in the human body. And I wanted to ask the doctors, could you make it almost analogous cancers to the to different viruses, even though viruses are external and not part of the human body? But would you say cancers are almost analogous to different types of viruses, but they're our body born instead of something external? Would that be a good analogy?
And perhaps in the same way that viruses can mutate?
Yeah, I mean...
And just the thousands of different viruses, each one of them has a different treatment. You can't use the same treatment on every virus.
So I think there are some similarities. I will start by saying for decades, people have had interest in to what degree viruses may contribute to causing certain types of cancers. And there are uncommon forms of cancers that are caused by viruses. Certain hepatitis viruses can lead to cancer. In rare cases, the Epstein-Barr virus can contribute to certain lymphomas. And there are a few other examples. So there is a complete link there. I will say that many viruses can be definitively cured by the immune system or cocktails of treatment. And I think that HIV, for example, the progress in HIV, to some degree, we have borrowed some of the lessons in cancer treatment, in that one drug is insufficient. You often need multiple drugs in order to combat the virus. And similarly, you need often multiple drugs for cancer to try to combat cancer. So I think there's some similarities, but there are certainly key differences as well.
Yeah, and
go ahead, Dr. Imran, go ahead.
The analogy that you're trying to draw is actually very interesting to me. One way of looking at it would be that viruses are an external threat to the body. And cancer is an internal threat, just like we discussed that cells of your own body, a certain organ, a series of events happen, some known and some unknown, where your own cancer cells become into cancer cells. So I would look at it again with optimism. As oncologists, our job is to remain optimistic. Remember, there was a time that half of the world's population died of a simple flu. And at that time, probably people thought that there would be no advances, and probably every family, every country was touched by it. I would say similar is the state of affairs in the world of oncology, but if you compare 50 years ago versus now, we have made such advances that we hope that at some point we are also able to come up with therapies that treat cancer in a similar way.
I think Rich is just, it sounds like he thinks the promise to say I'm going to cure cancer, it would be analogous to saying I'm going to cure viruses.
Right. Okay. I think that exactly the fact that cancer is such a broad term.
Yeah.
And even the word breast cancer turns out to be a broad term.
Yeah.
When we look at breast cancers, there are multiple different kinds that need to be treated differently. And I think beyond showing interest and really a dedication to continuing funding and continuing research, he's correct in saying that it's really an overpromise to say you're going to completely eliminate cancer in 4 years.
Michael writes to us to say, Evan and guests, what is the state of research on tumor angiogenesis? Is that the right term? Angiogenesis?
Angiogenesis.
What is the state of research on tumor angiogenesis, the process by which a tumor attracts blood vessels to nourish itself and sustain its existence? The late Dr. Judah Folkman pioneered groundbreaking research in this area many years ago. Is the research progressing today?
So around the year 2000, there was tremendous promise in this field where, again, the concept is that if you look under the microscope, for a tumor to grow, it's growing quickly. It needs a blood supply, so new blood vessels have to be made. And Dr. Folkman had the theory that if you could somehow impede the growth of those new blood vessels, you would starve the tumors. And in fact, there's an important drug called bevacizumab that is used for many cancers routinely now that came out of that research. I would say that although that drug is active, it frequently needs to be used with other drugs in combination. It does not have a lot of single agent activity. So this has been an incremental improvement. It does not appear to be the home run that maybe we thought it would be in the year 2000, but there continues to be research in this area.
Mark writes to us to say, Evan, what do your guests think about the Alex Trebek story? A lot of talk about the language of beating cancer. Alex Trebek is someone with a big salary and a lot of support. Is it effective and fair to say that everyone should be trying to beat cancer? That's from Mark. So let me before we kick it to the guests to kind of talk about that, if anyone doesn't know, Alex Trebek, longtime host of Jeopardy, has, I want to say, pancreatic cancer. Released a video earlier this year at the time of diagnosis and said that he was going to try to, quote, beat it, that he was determined, that he was going to fight. His latest video update that I saw maybe a month or so ago said that he was doing well and that he plans to keep working. And so I think Mark's email is asking, how do we feel? Are we comfortable with the term beating cancer, war on cancer? And generally speaking, is that a healthy way to look at that? I'll start with you, Dr. Emma.
So, Evan, this is a very important point in the world of oncology. The war against cancer is a very aggressive one, but it has to be a very smart one. You have to know your enemy, and you have to know what treatments you have and what realistic expectations there are. There are times in cancer treatment that you have to make the right decision at the right time, being smart. So what we usually do is that when patients come to us, and in today's day and age, we have so much testing that we can do, and there are so many therapies that we have available. In, let's say, 50 years ago, if a doctor would come to your home, they would come with one bag and it would have five pills in it. But today we have this abundance of treatments. So that is a time of optimism. That is a time of hope. But at every juncture, we have to keep it a realistic and a smart fight. So yes, it's true that many times cancer is treated and it is cured where it is no longer in your body. But the reality of it is that still many cancers which are presented in advanced stage are incurable. So when you say you're going to beat cancer, it may mean that it is totally cured, but if it means that you are able to live a good quality of life for as long as possible and change it into, let's say, a chronic disease such as rheumatoid arthritis or something, then that is really how to look at it. But when there a time comes when a cancer is not being cured, or if all the treatments have been exhausted and all the clinical trial options have also been exhausted, then at that time, patients usually feel that, you know, I don't want to say that I'm not beating it. You are still beating that cancer by understanding that that may be a time to change your approach and to focus more on the symptoms of cancer. And eventually, if a patient is symptom-free or symptoms are well-controlled, that is where our colleagues in palliative care come to help us, where we make sure that all the transitions at the right time are made the right way. That is what I would call beating the cancer.
Okay. Doctor, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting because I think that for many patients, the war and the fight analogy works very well. I meet patients, they say, I want to fight this thing. And it's this implication that it's a battle that they're fighting. It's a way for them to channel their energy and focus on treating cancer. But there are other people who don't like those analogies at all. And I think we have to be sensitive to that. Particularly, you don't want to imply that somebody has lost the war or lost the battle.
Giving up if they choose not to take a certain treatment path, right?
Exactly. And I think that, you know, when I was first training, we often used this terminology, and frequently if a patient would die, we'd always say to the relatives, he was such a fighter, she tried to her best to win or something. And it's really not that the patient is trying or not. A lot of this is for reasons that we don't understand why some patients respond and others don't. So I think this is just a situation where we have to be sensitive to using this language and really individualize it to what patients want. I think for Alex Trebek, if this is helping him in a way of conceptualizing what's happening in his body, I think we should support that. But I can see how other people would react negatively.
Do you both agree then that for those patients who that language is motivating or helpful for, that's fine? You prefer to let the patients and families use that language as opposed to doctors themselves?
That's certainly the way I practice.
Fair?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. In our last few minutes here, if you're just joining us as we talk about cancer and the state of cancer research, you know, we look at different missions. And I think about local organizations that do remarkable work with cancer, with cancer research, with kids. There's Cure Childhood Cancer that do remarkable things to help families sort of navigate what's going on. There's obviously Camp Good Days. Camp Good Days was involved with Cancer Mission 2020, which was launched in 2010, started here in Rochester as a grassroots initiative with the ultimate end goal of making cancer a chronic and manageable illness by 2020. Are you comfortable, uncomfortable putting dates on things when it comes to research, especially those big grand goals? Because that, to me, sort of evokes the notion of Biden or Trump saying we're going to cure it in this term.
I agree with you. I think that these are very hard things to put dates around. I think it is somewhat reminiscent of Kennedy saying we're going to put a person on the moon by, you know, 8 years from now. And that was motivating and it was felt to be possible. But I think for a problem like cancer, dates are constructs that do set you up for disappointment.
And so maybe 30 seconds apiece here. When we think about the mindset going forward, people listening to my voice, maybe they have had a diagnosis or someone they love recently, or it's going to, I mean, it happens to so many of us. It could be any day, and we know that. So the mindset seems to be that the notion of progress and the quality of life expectations are at least changing. What would you say about that?
Yeah, in a short summary, I'll just say that the amount of progress that I have seen in cancer over the last decade has been absolutely phenomenal. Every week I see patients in my clinic who are thriving, who I know a decade ago wouldn't be alive anymore. I don't think as scientists and physicians we've done a good enough job communicating how much progress we've made. And we're on the cusp of even more advances because of our deep understanding of the genetics of cancer. Every month, new drugs are coming out that are highly effective in cancers. And it's really an incredible privilege and exciting time to be working in cancer. And if you're a patient who's suffering from cancer, it's a very optimistic time.
About 20 seconds. What do you think?
I think in today's day and age, if somebody gets diagnosed with cancer, it is not the same as grandma that was seen at that time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of treatment options. Your oncology team will get the best treatment, and cautious optimism is really what my message would be.
We have a really remarkable medical system here in Rochester, and I want to thank our guests for sharing their expertise with us this hour. You just heard Dr. Farhan Imran, a hematologist and oncologist at the Lipson Cancer Institute at Rochester Regional Health. Thank you for your expertise.
Thank you.
And thanks for the expertise and insight from Dr. Jonathan Friedberg, director of UR Medicine's Wilmot Cancer Institute. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Our thanks to Don, who's volunteering, and Rob Braden. Happy birthday, Rob. It doesn't end in a zero, does it? It does end in a zero. Happy birthday to you, Rob Braden, the best engineer I've ever worked with here. And Megan Mack is an outstanding producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.